ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Have you ever wondered how our fingers and toes form during embryonic development? Welcome to ID, the Future. I'm your host, Andrew McDermott. And today my guest is Dr. Jonathan McClatchy to continue our ongoing series unpacking the many examples of intelligently designed systems in biology. Today, we're talking about our digits. No, not our phone number, our fingers and toes, those dangly things on the ends of our arms and legs that make life so much more livable. Dr. McClatchy is a fellow and resident biologist at the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. He was previously an assistant professor at Sadler College in Boston, where he lectured on biology for 4 years. McClatchy holds a bachelor's degree in forensic biology, a master's in evolutionary biology, a second master's in medical and molecular bioscience, and a PhD in evolutionary biology. His research interests include the scientific evidence of design and nature, arguments for the existence of God, and New Testament scholarship. Jonathan is also founder and director of TalkAboutDoubts.com. Welcome, Jonathan.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on again.
So this interview is part of an ongoing series we're doing on ID the Future, unpacking numerous examples of design in biology. We've had discussions about the intelligent design of muscles, hearing, the sexual reproductive system, and the spicy problems it produces for a Darwinian paradigm, the blood clotting cascade that kicks in when we get injured. We've talked about the irreducible complexity of bacterial cell division and the bacterial flagellum. We've looked at the properties of carbon and other non-metal elements that allow for complex life to flourish. And we've reviewed the life-giving qualities of water and sunlight. So we've talked about it quite a bit, but there's still plenty to go. There really are so many examples of design and fine-tuning in the natural world, we really could be at this a while. But today, our attention turns to our digits, our fingers and our toes, and how the origin of our digits points to a process that requires foresight. You wrote about this recently at evolutionnews.org. So, during early development, the hands and feet actually begin as solid webbed structures. Through a process called apoptosis, the tissue between them is eliminated, facilitating the separation of the digits. Now, you include in your writing a useful metaphor for this process in your article. Can you share that with us?
Sure. So, this is a metaphor that I actually took from a paper called Shaping Organisms with Apoptosis by Suzanne and Steller. And they noted that the role of apoptosis can be compared to the work of a stone sculptor who shapes a stone by progressively chipping off small fragments of material from a crude block, eventually creating a form. And so I thought that was a very apt illustration for the way that our digits actually form through the process of apoptosis, where space between our digits actually dissolves through the process of programmed cell death, creating the forms that make up our fingers and toes.
Yeah, it's a great analogy. And listeners, bear that in mind as we go through this, because it really helps you to kind of understand the whole process. Okay, so remind us about the process known as necrosis and how it differs from apoptosis.
Sure. So when a cell dies as a result of acute injury, the cell tends to swell and burst, and it releases its contents into the surrounding tissue. And this is a process known as necrosis, which is derived, of course, from the Greek word nekros, meaning dead. And it can result in an inflammatory response that can be damaging to the surrounding cells. Whereas by contrast, when a cell dies by apoptosis, it's much more clean and tidy, if you will. So during apoptosis, the cytoskeleton breaks down and the nuclear envelope disassembles, and the genetic material gets broken down into tiny fragments, and the surface of the cell is modified such that it attracts macrophages that engulf or phagocytose at the cell before its contents are able to spill out into the surrounding tissue and cause damage.
Okay, so we're dealing with a cleaner process, apoptosis. Now, the main question you're posing in your article is this: how could such a developmental process involving programmed cell death evolve in a gradual, incremental fashion without any awareness of where the target is? Let's keep that question in mind as we look at this whole process, how it's regulated and controlled. First, walk us through how apoptosis is initiated.
Sure. So there are regions known as the interdigital mesenchyme, which are essentially the zones of undifferentiated cells between what will eventually become the digits. And it's here that apoptosis is initiated by signaling molecules. So for instance, bone morphogenetic proteins are BMP for short, it's a helpful abbreviation, are secreted. So these are secreted signaling molecules that are critical for inducing apoptosis in the cells of the interdigital spaces. And knocking out these BMP molecules has actually been shown to result in webbed feet in chickens. And these BMPs are upregulated in the regions between the forming digits, and this results in cellular death and tissue regression. These BMPs bind to receptors on the surface of target cells in the developing limb bud, and this in turn activates intracellular SMAD molecules, which translocate to the nucleus and regulate the expression of pro-apoptotic and anti-apoptotic genes. So, for example, pro-apoptotic genes such as BAX and BAC are upregulated, and anti-apoptotic genes such as BCL2 are downregulated. And that facilitates cell death in areas where tissue needs to be removed. And the activity of BMPs is regulated by antagonists such as Noggin, which binds directly to BMPs, forming a complex that inhibits them from interacting with their receptors. And this makes sure that apoptosis only occurs in the interdigital spaces while preserving the cells that will form the digits.
Okay. All right. And as you were explaining that, I was reminded that, gosh, our listeners could be tuning into an engineering podcast. You know, there's so many similar terms used to describe what's going on biologically. It's quite amazing. Now, a family of proteases called caspases comprise the molecular machinery responsible for apoptosis. Tell us about these executioner caspases.
Sure. So, as you said, there's a family of proteases that are known as caspases that comprise the molecular machinery that carries out apoptosis, and these proteases are initially produced as inactive precursors, known as procaspases, and in response to apoptosis-inducing signals, they are activated, and executioner caspases are responsible for dismantling essential cellular proteins. These are themselves cleaved and thereby activated by initiator caspases. And one executioner caspase targets for destruction the lamin proteins that comprise the nuclear lamina, resulting in its disintegration. And this facilitates the entry of the nucleases into the nucleus, where they degrade the cell's DNA. Other targets of executioner caspases include the cytoskeleton and other critical cellular proteins as well.
Okay. You know, something I found very interesting is that caspases are initially produced as inactive precursors, called, you guessed it, right? Procaspases. Pro meaning in front of or before. What are these procaspases doing while they wait for the signal to initiate cell death?
Sure. So inactive procaspases roam and they are in wait for a signal to activate the death program and kill the cell. And so they have to be, of course, as you might gather, very carefully controlled and regulated. The BCL2 family of proteins is responsible for regulating caspase activation. So some of these proteins promote activation of caspases and apoptosis, while others negatively regulate these processes. Two essential proteins for promoting cell death are BAX and BAC, and these proteins trigger the release of cytochrome C from the mitochondria. And other BCL2 family proteins sequester apoptosis by inhibiting BAX and BAC from releasing cytochrome C. And critical to a cell's survival is the balance between the activities of the pro-apoptosis and anti-apoptosis BCL2 family members.
Yeah, which we'll touch on again shortly. Mm-hmm. Now, this idea of cellular elements being in an inactive state until they receive the signal to activate is really a hallmark of engineering, of design with the end in mind. It's looking ahead at a future function and putting in place what will be needed to produce that function. Now, you note that a cell's death program can be initiated in a couple of different ways. Tell us about that and which one is associated with our digits.
Sure. So there are two ways in which the cell's death program can be initiated. So there's the intrinsic pathway and there's the intrinsic pathway. And the extrinsic pathway is initiated by external signals, as the name suggests, through the binding of ligands to death receptors on the cell surface, whereas the intrinsic pathway is triggered by signals from within the cell itself, again, as its name suggests, and the formation of digits, which is what we're discussing here, is associated with the intrinsic pathway.
Okay. Now, the activity of caspases must be carefully controlled, otherwise cells would not survive. And this presents another conundrum for their origins. How could they arise without a mechanism in hand for holding them in check until required? Do Darwinists have an answer for that?
No, I believe this represents actually a formidable challenge to evolutionary explanations of their origins.
Okay. Do they even attempt to answer this? I mean, do they throw in co-option as a way to push back on it, or do they have anything?
I haven't seen in the literature a cogent explanation to give or attempt to give a detailed account of the origins of these caspases. As you rightly pointed out, how could they arise without having already simultaneously a mechanism in hand for holding them in check? And so this is, I think, a very difficult conundrum for an evolutionary explanation of their origins.
Yeah. Well, you have an image in your article, and listeners will link to that in the show notes for this episode so that you can go back and look, because you got to look at this stuff. You got to wrestle with its complexity. You got to get eyes on it. But you have an image in your article of a wheel-like structure called the apoptosome. What part does that apparatus play in the process?
Sure. So upon release of cytochrome C that I alluded to earlier from the mitochondria, the cytochrome C molecules bind to APOF1, which stands for apoptotic protease activating factor 1. And this protein has a specific region called the WD40 repeat domain that interacts with cytochrome C. And this binding induces a conformational change in APOF1, which allows it to oligomerize. And the APOF1 monomers thus assemble into a large heptameric complex known as the apoptosome. And this wheel-like structure serves as a scaffold for further recruitment of procaspase 9 molecules. And within the apoptosome, the proximity of multiple procaspase 9 molecules results in their autocleavage and activation. And this induces a caspase cascade involving the activation of downstream effector caspases such as caspase 3 and caspase 7, and this ultimately results in a programmed cell death.
Okay, and it has that unique shape just because of how it folds. Is it a collection of proteins? Is that what this structure is?
Yes, exactly. It's a complex.
Okay, yeah, it really is a beautiful structure. Listeners, I encourage you to take a look. Well, let's go back to the metaphor you offered early in the discussion, likening the process of apoptosis to stone sculpting. An actual stone sculptor has a vision of the final form, the ability to visualize a distant outcome. Can natural selection do the work of a stone sculptor?
So an actual stone sculptor has a vision, of course, of the final form, or the ability to visualize a distant outcome. Whereas a feature of natural selection, as you know, is that it lacks foresight, it lacks awareness of complex angles. And so how can a mindless cause select for a process of carefully regulated programmed cell death during development without knowledge of the target? It seems counterintuitive and strikes at the very heart of the evolutionary rationale or evolutionary process. Natural selection is blind to complex angles. And so how could natural selection preserve a process of programmed cell death, which is a destructive process, without knowledge of where the target lies?
Yeah, because you have to keep that process in check, you know, because unchecked cell death program, you know, equals just death all around. And it really doesn't make sense. But it's a conundrum for sure. For a Darwinian paradigm. Well, Jonathan, why is intelligent design a more adequate explanation for the origin of our digits?
Well, it would seem to me that any process that is capable of producing this sort of mechanism would have to be a process that has intelligence and foresight. As I said before, the ability to visualize complex higher-level objectives Which are characteristics that have been uniquely associated with a conscious mind. And so I think that there's a top-heavy likelihood ratio that these sorts of features are not particularly surprising, supposing a mind is involved that can visualize complex higher-level objectives, but are wildly surprising, supposing that no mind is involved. And so in view of that top-heavy likelihood ratio, I'm very heavily inclined to favor a design hypothesis.
Right. And one of the things that I like about our discussions and about your articles at Evolution News is that you're helping to build that cumulative case. I mean, if it was just about our digits and, you know, just about this one system, then okay, you know, you might put that down to coincidence. But when you start adding it all up, you know, when you start building that cumulative case about all the different systems in biology that have these hallmarks of design and irreducible complexity, you end up, you know, overwhelmed. And you, and if again, if you go back to that scale, you start to see which part of the scale is tipping, you know, and heavier. So
that's absolutely really, right. And the Bayes factors, which is the likelihood ratio of the probability of the evidence given the hypothesis in this case of design versus the probability of that same evidence given the falsity of the hypothesis, these Bayes factors multiply together. And so the evidential force multiplies exponentially with each successive example. And so there is a real power, I think, in developing the argument as a cumulative case.
Yeah. And listeners, if you caught what Jonathan just said, he talked about the Bayes, you know, theorem, Bayes logic, Bayesian logic. You know, if that's foreign to you, Jonathan and I actually did an introduction to Bayesian logic as it pertains to intelligent design. Just go back and look for that. Just search Bayes or Bayesian, B-A-Y-E-S, at idthefuture.com, and you'll find that. Because I thought that was a really accessible introduction to how we can look at this likelihood ratio of the evidence and watch it mount up in the case for intelligent design. Well, Jonathan, I didn't have this you know, listed as a question I would ask you, but just for kicks, I mean, it's kind of obvious. I said that, you know, it would be hard to live without these digits, you know, our fingers and toes. But just off the top of your head, why are these digits so important to us?
Well, of course, they allow us to pick things up and engage in fine motor movements. We can so there's many things that our fingers and toes allow us to do that we wouldn't be able to do otherwise. Writing with a pencil, for example, is kind of hard to do if you don't have any fingers.
And you have the privilege of watching your young child right now be all into things with their fingers and toes. And I bet that's a rewarding experience and sometimes annoying, probably, when they pick up things they shouldn't.
Yeah.
I know I remember that phase. But yeah, I mean, there's no question that we couldn't get by without these. And so it's good to kind of probe the origins and really look at, you know, whether a Darwinian process could produce these amazing things that we hold dear. Well, Jonathan, thank you for joining us today to discuss this. You promise you'll be back, of course, to keep on going with our series. If you do want more of Dr. McClatchy's articles on these topics, of course, you can go to Evolution News. That's our powerhouse website that is updated on a daily basis with multiple new articles, commentating and reporting on the news about intelligent design and evolution. Jonathan is writing regularly there. That's evolutionnews.org. And if you want a bigger picture of everything that he's into and all his research interests, you can, of course, go to jonathanmcclatchy.com. Try spelling McClatchy, good Scottish name there. You don't want to get confused with that. M-C-L-A-T-C-H-I-E, McClatchy.com. jonathanmcclatchy.com. Well, Jonathan, thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, if you enjoy what you're hearing on ID the Future, do help us reach new listeners by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and forwarding an episode to a friend. And remember, in addition to all the major podcast platforms, ID the Future is available on YouTube as well. Subscribe to the Discovery Science channel to get your fill of interviews, animations, and original video series, as well as every single episode of ID the Future. You can get all that at youtube.com youtube.com/@discoveryscience channel. That's the actual URL. Discovery Science on YouTube. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for joining me.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.